Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And, excuse me, and welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And it's all about compliance with the Constitution. And now we actually get into the opening, because we kind of watched the engineering, the design of putting everything together, but we didn't get a real good chance of how engrossed the debates were. Most people, I think, looked at Madison's notes, and they are insightful. I think they thought that his notes would cover a level of detail to completely understand, like the militia, or because most of the people in the convention came with a lot of knowledge. Believe it or not, folks, even back then, there were people that didn't understand certain things. And you're going to find, you know, people asking, legitimately, some people were asking, you know, I'll just say exploratory questions because they just didn't understand some of the topics. And some that did, those were the ones that became, you know, ardently against and or supporting of. But there were quite a bit of people. And so we're going to kind of look at the ratification debates kind of from a macro as well as a micro. Because one of the things I want to show you, and I want you to, we'll do it at least a few times. I want to show you the list of people that ended up signing off on ratifying the Constitution. In some states, they were pretty small states, it wasn't pretty big. And as a matter of fact, those states that usually just rubber stamped it, they didn't have a high attendance and high, and maybe they didn't have a room big enough. I don't know. But some of these were huge. I know Massachusetts was huge. And we're going to examine Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania is the most unique as far as a document goes because the ratification debates from Pennsylvania do not include any of the anti-federalist comments, which is great. I wish that somebody would have sterilized all of the ratification debates so that you had, this is what the Constitution was ratified based on. And then you had over here, this pile of everything, the amalgamation or the glumfry, whatever you want to call it, just this huge, you know, pile and mixture of all of the different things that they captured in the process of ratifying from the anti-federalist comments and so forth. The reason why the anti-federalist comments are insignificant, other than they could be insightful, but they're insignificant because those comments were rejected. When they made the decision, they had a choice to either accept the Federalists or the proponents and accepting the Constitution by ratifying it, which means that they accepted how they stipulated, how they explained the Constitution. And if they didn't accept it, then that means that they rejected the Federalist and how they sold the Constitution, and they listened to and adhered and they believed the Anti-Federalist over the Federalist. So the real question is, if a state wouldn't have ratified, how important would the ratification debates be? Well, really not at all, because other than you can look at how the Federalists or the Anti-Federalists may have won the argument, but when we look at the details and so forth, it's moot because they didn't accept it. Now, it may have been one of those big setups because I know with Virginia, and I'm pretty sure it was the same with New York, they stooped to a lot of different levels. When they discovered that they had to basically create a representative convention by not using the state legislature, going to the people and letting the people choose, there was a lot of gerrymandering in how those elections were going to be held because they knew who, you know, were friends of their agenda and who weren't friends of their agenda. And Patrick Henry, was down in Virginia, was notorious for making sure that he watered down his, I'll just call them enemies, those people who weren't on board with his agenda, so that they would have less influence. He had so much influence that he was capable and successful in keeping James Madison from being the senator to represent Virginia in the very first session of Congress, because he hated Madison. Madison was in his eyes, Madison was the creature that helped ratify that Constitution and got it across the finish line, and he didn't deserve any credit or didn't deserve any, you know, any benefit for doing what he did. And so, and Patrick Henry, interesting man. There's a lot of people that have written about him. Interesting man when you look at him in context of the Constitution. He was an iron horse when it came down to liberty and fight standing up against Britain. But and some of the comments I actually have highlighted, because he brings up some points that help identify, you know, some of the weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation, and or he brings up points that help argue against those people who really think, a good point, case in point. Patrick Henry brings up the fact that the Constitution does not establish common law as the law of the land. How many people do you know run around and say, hey, we're supposed to have common law? Constitution, you know, guarantees us common law. No, it doesn't. Now, it does say in the 7th article, or I should say the ninth article of the Bill of Rights, but in the 7th bill or the 7th amendment, it basically says in cases of common law, in other words, if a state is using common law and the controversy is over $20, the right to a trial by jury shall be preserved. And they don't say how that's going to be done. And this goes back to the concept of the federal courts were not to dictate the legal system, and the federal courts were to conform to the states to ensure that they would apply what was appropriate in that state with its legal system. So in other words, this idea that the court was the, you know, these oracles to dictate from on high, this is how you will see the law, and this is how you will enforce the laws we create. I mean, they've assumed so many powers. It's just ridiculous. So we have to start challenging those things, and by reading the ratification debates, we'll be able to do that. But anyway, one of the things that we're going to dive into, the first thing we need to dive into, is this Constitution had actually departed from the delegates. And we covered this when we read the Constitution. So when you read Article 7, which is talking about the ratification, then everything after that are instructions from the Constitutional Convention to Continental Congress of what they recommend, you know, they do with the Constitution. And I mentioned before that Continental Congress received the Constitution first. It did not go to the states. It was up to them whether they were going to agree with what they did. And so this is what Continental Congress stated, and this is on September 28th. Now, of course, Continental Congress is meeting just around the corner, or they're, I believe they're meeting at this point in time in New Jersey or somewhere close by. No. Congress having received the report, okay, assembled in Pennsylvania. Does it say where they're assembled here at the time? It doesn't. Anyway, if you look, they're probably kind of close by, because giving them the Constitution on the 17th, signing it and sending it off, and them responding in just literally 11 days, that's a pretty quick turnaround. But this is what they say. The United States in Congress assembled Friday, September 28, 1787. Present New Hampshire. Now, these are the delegates or the representatives of the states that are there: New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. And from Maryland, Mr. Ross. And so I think Mr. Ross was a delegate for somebody else, because at this point in time, some of the states, and Maryland was one of them, had a hard time funding their own delegates, so they actually had a proxy from some other state, since they were going to be there. Would you vote for us too? Because we like how you vote, and you dress dapper, you know, like you came from Maryland. However they set that kind of thing up, that's what they did. And so anyway, Congress, having received the report of the convention lately assembled in Philadelphia, resolved, so this is what they're saying, resolved unanimously that the said report with the resolutions and letter accompanying the same be transmitted to the several legislatures in order to be submitted to a convention of delegates chosen in each state by the people thereof in conformity to the resolves of the convention and made that in that provided in that case, Charles Thomas Secretary, who I guess was the one that wrote this, and this was printed by the Dunlap Claypool Company, and I guess maybe he's the one that signed it too, but anyway, Charles Thomas. So that being said, this went out. It went out, and now the state legislatures received this thing, and I don't think they were happy. Because apparently, at least in some of the states, that realized that these guys did a better job than anybody gave them credit for. Because they actually gave them a turnkey system that solved the problems. They gave them a government that the world had never seen. And yet, it was instantly being rejected, and there were people that went into a meltdown. Because they saw the power that they were possessing in their own little sphere of a state melting away. Which is why we see the rancor, which is why we see, you know, this visceral coming at these guys for doing what they did and attacking them and impugning them. I would not be surprised to hear that there may have been offers of duels in defending one's honor. I think anybody could be safe in attacking James Madison and not be, you know, concerned about him challenging you to a duel, because James Madison just wasn't that guy. He was a small, very small statured guy. I think 5'3", 5'4", very small. And he was the smallest president ever, and yet he was the only president that led troops, actual war-fighting troops with guns loaded to point at bad guys, only active president that actually worked and served with the troops, the commander-in-chief with the forces. So, anyhow, moving on, welcome back, Tammy, welcome back, Sean. What we're going to do is we're going to dive into these ratification debates. Now, what I want to do first is I want to focus. We'll just do these things alphabetically, folks, so you can get these all off of the Reclaiming the Republic academic source document page. Now, the contested debates, you're more than welcome to get to read, but you're going to want to come back and download them when we're done, because as we go through these, I'm going to be trying to use a finer tooth comb, because I've already gone through them with different degrees of fine teeth, and finding very important assertions, very important clarifications, elucidations, pure stipulations and legal definitions of what that Constitution meant, or that line, that word in the Constitution meant. And so I'm hoping that I'll be providing some new views to some of this. And one of the things I'm looking to add, because there's way too many people that I don't know where this misinformation comes, because I put it out there in Why Counties Matter Most that every state in the union at the time of the Constitution's ratification, every state in the union was differently configured. Some states didn't have an executive, and you've heard me say this. Some states didn't have a judiciary. Some states only had one legislative body, and so forth and so on. So we're going to actually go through, and we're going to highlight, not the GRs telling you this, you're going to actually see these words come up because we've already brought these up in Madison's notes. So when you hear people say, you know, before a state could ratify the Constitution, they had to set up a bicameral legislative body. Sean, have you ever heard that stipulation?
No, I did not.
Tammy, how about you?
Yeah. Yes.
No, I've actually had, and the source is not academic, and the individual, you know, lives with AI and all. I mean, in other words, almost anything and everything that they read in print, they almost believe. So I know, contrary, that there's no substance to the claim. But apparently, I've been told that this is common, that this movement out there trying to help everybody understand that every state government was being forced to change its government to conform to the Constitution. Now, that flies in the face of exactly what the framers did. They knew that if they had to, and maybe people are starting to say, hey, you know, GR's got these points that we can't refute, so let's create this. It doesn't make sense why they would try to create a lie or misdirection. It just doesn't make sense. Why I am hearing now, instead of them actually reading, because if you go to Google and you just search what was the configuration of the state of Delaware in 1789, they will come back and tell you at that point in time, prior to the Constitution, Delaware had a government configured like this. Now, you could even go to 1790. They'll tell you when they had their Constitutional Convention to change their form of government, but that wasn't required. It was not required. So the source and the misinformation I find is really, really interesting. But that being said, my point is that when we go into these debates and as we open up, and what we're going to do is we're going to open up the first one. And let me see here. What do we want to do for the first one? Well, I said we're going to do this alphabetically. So let's just do that alphabetically. That would be, let me see here. Is it Delaware? Do I hear anything? Oh, Connecticut, that's right.
Connecticut.
C before D. Okay, so Connecticut. Thank you very much. I had to get to the folder. Okay, so we've got Connecticut. We're looking at Connecticut ratifying January 4th. So this is just before Massachusetts meets. Massachusetts meets, if I remember correctly, later in January. And I think it is during Pennsylvania ratification debates, because I don't think that they had submitted anything. But let's go to the end here, because Pennsylvania was the first state that actually sought out amendments to the Constitution. And it got duplicated by Massachusetts, and then Massachusetts actually got the credit for it. And so as I go through this, I don't see anything of amendments or anything like that. So as we look at this, there's a table of all the signatures. And if you look at Connecticut, there's a lot of names there. Interestingly enough, they don't break down the names from their locations. And so when we get to some of the states, you'll actually notice that they break them down by county. And that when they ratified, they ratified basically like delegations because they kept track of how everybody voted. Now, in this particular case, I don't see yays or nays. Senator set our hands. All right. And there was so it was unanimous. As I look at this, I'm going, there's no differentiation in Connecticut that identifies whether they voted for, against, and we're seeing all these names, and I'm guessing they all voted for it because it was rubber stamped. But I really doubt it. I believe that some of these men probably voted against it, but nevertheless, they're not giving us that information. They're just saying that it was ratified on January 8th. January 8th, 4 days after they met in convention. Now, I don't know, Tammy, you've been to some party conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Usually there's an administrative lag time at the beginning of the convention, right? How fast do they get to that gavel and start meeting?
I mean, first you meet in committees for the first 2 days and then...
Yeah, but don't you... Aren't there credentials? You have to provide credentials that you are the delegate from this county, so forth. So there's this process of receiving the delegates and credentials, right?
Yeah, that takes place on the day before.
There you go. So it took a day ahead of time to go through the credentials and accounting and all of that. So, and that's just the administrative stuff that we go through today. They had to go through the same thing back then. But, and maybe they're just, you know, they know everybody by name. I don't know. But my point is that they did this in 4 days. They ratified it. They walked away and said, yeah, come on, Constitution. Yeah,
that's pretty amazing, actually.
And believe it or not, somebody came up with a bunch of oration here because as we're looking, there is 14 pages. That's a lot. I mean, for somebody to kind of talk and so forth. And folks, I wouldn't tell you not to read this. But these are not debates. These are basically somebody getting up and making their, you know, their presentation on why we need to just do this, why this is so important, what have you. But you're not seeing somebody standing up and saying, well, I got a problem with this, I got a problem with that, like we see in all of the rest of the debates. Connecticut is literally one of those states that goes, you know what, we're listening to this guy, and we're all pumped up. Give us the quiver, and we will start, you know, signing this thing. Now, interestingly enough, there is a dialogue that Mr. Huntington on January 9th kind of gets up and makes a post comment. But they say at the very bottom of this that this was ratified on January 8th, so the day before. So. Anywho, I guess they had some lively caucusing. So back in those days, another thing that was kind of part of the course is when they would meet, it's like when Congress would meet or when the delegates would meet at the convention, they would continue caucusing. That's what they called it. At the local pub where they would have dinner and drinks because, you know, they don't have a kitchen, a family, a wife to go to. These guys are out on business, on travel, and so they would all kind of go to and they'd gravitate towards a pub. Now, you might have heard that the Marine Corps was born in Tun Tavern in Pennsylvania, or Philadelphia specifically. That happened because Continental Congress at the time was caucusing in Tun Tavern when they decided to create the Marine Corps. And so they kind of did it that way. So this caucusing idea was something that kind of helped them continue work and exploring answers to questions and so forth without belaboring the debates and the time And, you know, when you're formally doing it, you just can't drink, you know, alcohol. So getting into the pub, you can. So that's we'll be right back after this short message.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as I was just saying, they weren't much different than today, where a lot of people would love to just, you know, have some drinks and do business. Back in those days, though, they kind of had a higher, you know, they were an enlightened society, so they embraced the concepts of discipline, where today, discipline is, you know, people don't even understand, they don't apply it. I mean, why? People go to excesses. They didn't have DUI problems and so forth, because at least these men, I mean, there were a few that got drunk and got, you know, rowdy and loud, but they maintained control. Plus, they lived in a time when alcohol wasn't, you know, 200% or 200 proof, 100% alcohol. The distilled liquor was much milder than it was today, or than it is today. And the same thing probably with beer, ale, and so forth. But they paced themselves. They maintained a level of, while they're drinking, a level of sobriety to the fact that they can continue working. So anyway, I wouldn't think that maybe they, you know, didn't have their time caucusing, you know, while they were away from their families and having their meals and so forth. But this happened really fast. Now, the next one that I would like to go to would be Delaware. And Delaware was supposedly the first. And when you look at Delaware meeting December 7th, interestingly enough, they were, the second or the third meeting, they were just the first to ratify, because Pennsylvania was still slugging it out. Now, when you look at this, this is literally one page, right? Everybody seeing this? You may be muted. I know Sean is.
Yeah, I see it.
Okay. And in looking at this, they've identified who's from what county. And Delaware being this big metropolis type of state of the time, you know, it had a whole three counties. Where when we look at some of these other states, actually with Virginia, I'll even note that they kind of segregate Kentucky, because Kentucky was already being earmarked as becoming a state at that point in time. And so you kind of see that being done. But here they basically met on December 7th. And I have no idea how long they met, but they ratified it pretty quickly, right out the gate. And, I mean, no diatribe, nothing. I mean, this is what I would call an official rubber stamp. In other words, they're not out to impress anybody with, you know, their deep thought of things that they think the Constitution could use. Boom. Let's move forward. And to, you know, let me see here. Yeah, I don't see any deliberation of time passing or anything. So there you go with Delaware. Delaware is literally one of those really quick states. Now, in the next one, which is Georgia, I believe Georgia's much later. And so this is going to give us, I believe, a little bit of reading. Nope. When did Georgia? January 2nd. So they met, I think they again met before Philadelphia, or not Philadelphia, Pennsylvania had finished their ratification debates. And so they didn't offer. So we now have a third state from Connecticut, Delaware, and now Georgia, a third state that rubber stamped for the most part. Now, Connecticut, there was a lot of dialogue, but boom, ratified. Georgia, really quick. Delaware, really quick. And so we're looking at one page, and then you're actually looking at Effingham, Burke, Richmond, Wilkes, Liberty, Camden, Washington, and then Greene. I believe that these are representatives that are coming from counties. So the county is to the right, and then the name is to the left. Names to the left, because there's a couple of names for three names for one county and so forth. So this was done by county. And let me see here. What was the county that had a problem with the Trump election, the voter fraud? Any of you remember? If I hear it.
Which one didn't?
No. But there's one that actually.
Georgia?
Yeah, in Fulton Georgia. What was that?
Fulton County.
Yeah, okay, that's it. And I don't see it here. So, or it would have just boom, jumped out. So, apparently, that county didn't exist. If you look at Georgia today, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 counties, and today they almost have 200. Almost 200 counties today. I think Atlanta, it comprises of 20-some, almost 30 counties. Wow. So, yeah, these are small counties. Because they wanted to make sure that there was proper representation in that county to, you know, for them to legislate themselves. Now, whether they still have legislative powers at the county, probably not, because of what the Supreme Court did in the 1960s and so forth. But nevertheless, I mean, just if you take a quick overview of each of these short ratification debates, you go, oh, wow, okay. So this was kind of quick, no amendments or anything. All right, so we go to the next one, and this is Maryland. Now, this is a little bit longer, and this was in April. And so without knowing, we've already gone through the Constitution. But what I want to do and what we're going to do, because you'll see here that there is a list of amendments down the road. And you'll actually find some of these amendments are highlighted, and many of them are not. And that's only because prior to this, I had no idea which one we would start off with and so forth. But prior to this, when I've read these before, we actually went through all of them in the first one. And I just say that because there were some that were unique, and then some that were all kind of common. But if you look here, there are how many total amendments? There are a total of 13. And then there are additional amendments that they lay out that come to 16. And then they vote and they provide the details of the how it was voted on the affirmative and the negative. So they actually show you who voted and who voted for and who voted against. So now we actually have a little bit more granularity, but let's go through these amendments. Now, actually, they started, let's cover the 21st. When did they ratify? When was the formal ratification provided? Does it say? Maybe it was the 21st and they convened and they just don't cover when they convened. Or when they Yeah, when they convened, when they got together.
April 28, 1788.
As the ratification?
Correct.
Okay. I've not seen that. Is it the bottom?
No, I got it from a different source.
A different source altogether, because they didn't put it in. All right, that's fine. So let's start off with these amendments towards the top. The Congress shall have the power, shall exercise no power, but what is expressly delegated in the Constitution. So that very first amendment is the 12th Amendment. Ends up becoming the 12th Amendment, right? And then they and in this they kind of provide, you know, the bit of details. By this amendment, the general power is given to Congress. So in other words, they're giving some details to it. So, Tammy, why don't you read the Second Amendment that they wanted to put in? Go ahead.
That there shall be trial by jury in all criminal cases according to the course of proceeding in the state where the offense is committed, and that there be no appeal, matter of fact, or second trial after acquittal, but this provision shall not extend to such cases as may arise in the government of the land or naval forces.
Okay, so they wanted a level of protection in the criminal cases so that if somebody was acquitted, they couldn't be tried again. So this is kind of like a few different amendments of protection from government trying to go after somebody and railroading them into jail and, you know, silencing them, oppressing them, what have you. Because that was a real problem back in those days. That's why the framers were so sensitive of trial by jury. It was sacred. Sacred, because it was your peers that would give you justice. They knew that. Okay, so Sean, let's try the Third Amendment. Go ahead.
That in all actions on debts or contracts and in all other controversies respecting property of which the inferior federal courts have jurisdiction, the trial of facts shall be by jury, if required by either party, and that it be expressly declared that state courts in such cases have a concurrent jurisdiction with the federal courts, with an appeal from either only as to matter of law to the Supreme Federal Court, if the matter in dispute be of the value of blank dollars.
Okay, this right here actually ends up becoming a couple of different amendments, but what's interesting is they're kind of trying to limit the jurisdiction in the appeal only as to matter of law. In other words, you can't bring any new facts, new evidence, or anything. If the appeal is to move forward, you get a conviction, then you can't allow the defense to present new evidence or anything like that. They want to make sure that the only thing the appeal is going to do by the federal government, because they're afraid that the federal government, if they've got justice in their state and the federal government really wants to go after them and let that person go, then they could then start bringing in new evidence. Because of this evidence, we're going to overturn your conviction and let you go. They didn't trust government. The justice that they got, they wanted to keep. They wanted to make sure that government couldn't change the outcome, or they wanted to make sure that if the outcome changed, it really needed to be changed for a specific purpose. And in this case, that only purpose was in the matter to law, not to the, you know, different evidence and so forth. Does that make sense? So again,
yes, sir.
So again, they're focused in this amendment regarding the jurisdiction of the court. So now we look at three amendments so far, and two of them are very concerned about the federal court systems, trial by jury and so forth. And so the Fourth Amendment, go ahead, Tammy.
That the inferior federal court shall not have jurisdiction of less than blank dollars, and that there may be an appeal in all cases of revenue, as well as well to matter of fact as law and Congress may give the state courts jurisdiction of revenue cases for such forms and in such manner as they may think proper.
So, again, something focused on the court, and they want to make sure that there is a tie or a limitation or a threshold, whether it be a ceiling or a floor, to dollars. We see that in the Seventh Amendment, that in a controversy of greater than $20 of common law, the trial by jury shall be preserved. And $20, what was $20 back in those days? I mean, it wasn't an annual income, but it was significant enough to where they said, you know what? No way. We're going to make sure that a judge can't railroad somebody for years. I mean, look at today. And if somebody did the cost analysis of what the $20 would have been back then to the $20 around the year 2000. And I say around the year 2000 because even though our government had been inflating our currency, it didn't hit hyperinflation like it has in the 2000s. So I believe that you can't match it to today because if the numbers really start getting skewed because of government manipulation, not because of the true cost of living. So when you look at, and I believe I was talking to a lawyer, and I think he told me that it was somewhere around $300-$400. $20 back then would have equated to about $300-$400. And actually, here's an interesting thing. When you look at the cost of gold just recently, I saw a comparison of a factory worker in the year 19,005 or 19,006, something like that, would make, and I think it was a monthly salary, of 5 gold coins. This year, based on the currency or based on the inflation of the value of gold, a factory worker in America would receive 1 gold coin.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you an idea of how hyperinflated our currency has gotten, where the value of gold has been devalued to that point. Anyway, 5, Sean, go ahead.
Number 5, that in all cases of trespasses done within the body of a county and within the inferior federal jurisdiction, the party injured shall be entitled to trial by a jury in the state where the injury shall be committed, and that it be expressly declared that the state courts in such cases shall have concurrent jurisdiction with the federal courts, and there shall be no appeal from either except on matter of law, and that no person be exempt from such jurisdiction and trial, but ambassadors and ministers privileged by the law of nations.
So this is the first time we actually see the county included, right? That they're recognizing the jurisdiction of a county.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so they wanted to make sure that when something was happening at the county level, that if there's an inferior federal jurisdiction, the party injured shall be entitled to a trial by jury in the state where the injury was committed. In other words, keeping that person from going out of state to have to travel to defend themselves and to try to get justice. Okay, so number 6, Tammy.
That the federal courts shall not be entitled to jurisdiction by fictions or collusion.
Okay. And so, out of all of these, it seems like there's a real theme here, doesn't there? These are all pointing to, their problems were pointing to the court and jurisdiction of the court over matters between a state and a citizen and or a citizen of another state and a state and even the foreigner. Because when we go through the debates, you're going to find that even in the vigorous debates, they had the exact same problem. Did you know how they fixed this after the Bill of Rights? Tammy, Sean?
No.
Was there an amendment that changed the jurisdiction of the court?
Oh, is it 12th?
The 11th. That's 11th. Right. In 1796, the states basically demanded that they peel back the federal jurisdiction, which was dealing with a lot of these types of things. Get them out of our knickers. We're not taking this. They no longer have jurisdiction over these things, and they quickly ratified that. It was one of the quick amendments that got ratified. Okay, so number seven, Sean.
Number seven, that the federal judges do not hold any other office of profit or receive the profits of any other office under Congress during the time they hold their commission.
All dealing with court, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so Tammy, let's go with eight now. We're down a little bit further.
Okay. That all warrants without oath or affirmation of a person conscientiously scrupulous of taking an oath to search suspected places or seize any person or his property are grievous and oppressive, and all general warrants to search suspected places or to apprehend any person suspected without naming or describing the place or person in special are dangerous and not to be granted.
Okay, so
keep going.
No. So that's the explanation. Okay. So following those amendments before, there was this long paragraph of the intent and the object of why they were submitting those amendments from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Mm-hmm. Actually, they already kind of provided an explanation with 1. So it was really more for 2, 3, 4, and 5, 6, and 7. And now they came up with 8, and they wanted to, again, provide an explanation. So from 2 through 8, which is a total of 7 amendments, all of this had to deal with protection of the citizens from the court and from the laws of the federal government, or I should say from the general government, being able to go after the citizens and, you know, hunting them down and dragging them out of their homes and so forth. Now, these next ones are more towards warfare, but let's go ahead and dive into these. Sean?
Number 9, that no soldier be enlisted for a longer time than 4 years, except in time of war, and then only during the war.
Okay, so trying to create a limitation to when a person in the militia was in federal service. Go ahead, Tammy. 10.
That soldiers be not quartered in time of peace upon private houses without the consent of the owners.
Okay, so it was already bitter with them from the Revolutionary War, how Britain kept on basically taking property and quartering themselves on the property of individuals, especially individuals that were not friendly to Britain. They would deliberately go after those who had any influence or affluence, money, size, you know, barns, and you know, the ability, because the larger the spread, probably the more money. And they would go in there, and they would quarter, and they would just take. One of the problems that they had prior to the Revolutionary War was this idea of judges getting commissions off of their guilty verdicts. Did you guys know this?
Still happens today.
Okay, so in their time, the judge would basically confiscate property for his payments. Or for the penalties.
Wow.
And so, I mean, it was direct corruption. And I'm not saying that it probably doesn't happen, but it's not as visible. I mean, at the end of the day, the judge is grabbing stuff out of these people's homes or stuff that's already been confiscated. This judge is taking this stuff and taking it home.
Wow.
Because they were entitled. The law allowed them to do that. So they wanted to see some amendments that protected their property. So in the Fifth Amendment, it talks about the confiscation of property, that property could not be confiscated without just... Does that mean real estate? No, that meant any kind of property, your car or what have you. To be clear, it meant any property because... The real problem was the fact that they would be getting robbed. there was no way the king was going to get that parcel of 25 acres, you know, folded up, put in somebody's back pocket, and brought back to England. That wasn't going to happen. So they didn't really take real property other than quartering themselves and occupying your property because it suited them. But taking your intrinsic, you know, valued property, your heirlooms or things that meant something to you or things that actually had, you know, luster and, oh, that's a nice piano. Anywho, who's next? The No Mutiny Bill. Let me do it. The No Mutiny Bill. Bill continue in force longer than 2 years. In other words, you can't just say, hey, you can't, you know, commit mutiny against what we're doing, you know, for indefinite amount of time. You know, you should be able to stand up and speak out, because what is mutiny?
That's when you run away from combat or service.
Well, so actually...
No, you turn on your...
there you go.
Commanders.
There you go. You turn on the commander, what have you. So in other words, they were actually in Maryland looking to be able to turn on their commanders after a certain period of time and say, hey, you know, you were wrong at doing this, and we're, you know, you had the protection, that your 2 years is up, and you were stupid enough not to skedaddle out of Maryland. Now that you're still here, we're coming after you. There you go. All right, so then they explain why these checks were put in there. And then number 12, who's next? Is it Sean or Tammy?
That the freedom of the press be inviolably preserved.
Okay, we kind of understand that. But do we, because back in those days, the press was not a platform. The press was an individual who went out and purchased, invested in buying paper, ink, and a printing press so that they could generate and produce. It was their livelihood, as well as, you know, they were providing a service of informing people. So the press itself and what they would print was to be printed, or I should say to be protected. In every state in the Union, the press in their constitution is basically defined as the citizen themselves are capable or are considered the press, that they can write anything that they choose to, that they want to. However, most all of the states say you will and can be held for liable if you are not truthful and it cannot prove the veracity of your assertions in your writings. So anyway, now we can get through the rest of this because we ran out of time. And that's what we'll do. We'll address the rest of these in our next episode, because there's still a few other ones that I kind of want to go through just to give you a good sampling of how everybody was looking at the Constitution after Massachusetts and Pennsylvania submitted amendments. And so they go, oh, we got to do that too. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.